His Holiness has heard of the story of KGB, for example, attempt to do some experiments on, you know, paranormal faculties and abilities, and perhaps CIA might have been involved in that too. So just because there is an... So, and if they have discovered something, probably it will be useful now in Iraq. So there will always be the potential for abuse.
Like a nuclear power, utilized for constructive way, good. But there is always a danger to utilize wrong way, destructive way.
So
So, as to what
can we find to counter this problem? His Holiness says he has got no idea. So there's a kind of a basic question to Phil's presentation where, with regard to the subliminal priming, what wasn't very clear was its effectiveness in changing people's attitudes. Mm-hmm. What seems to be obvious is that it's quite effective in determining what kind of emotional temperament, whether anxious or secure or you know, avoidant type, the individual may respond. That seems to be the subliminal kind of, you know, priming seem to kind of discern that quite effectively. But as to a method of radical transformation of the individual, His Holiness is wondering to what extent it could be effective, or whether it would be, you know, how would you rate that in relation to actual deliberate conscious cultivation?
It's a great question. I mean, we were mostly testing a theory, and so we want to see, does this affect this? But during lunch we talked about this a little bit. The Buddhist practices are conscious, deliberate. They're part of a program, you know, a long term effort. And we were talking in relation to other presentations this week that usually to transform your whole mind expectations, thinking, being mindful all the time and remembering these goals and everything, that obviously takes a lot of training. So I don't think there's, I don't think you could replace any kind of deliberate practices with this, but I do think that you could do some, since I believe what's happening is that it's reducing anxiety, if you know, this it's reducing the tendency toward grasping of certain kind. That I think you could use in conjunction with something else,
and more disposed towards.
Yeah, the place, just because of my own research interests and area, the place where I am talking to people about trying to do this kind of study is in the context of marital therapy. A typical situation in the United States is their husbands, wives are fighting, they're having trouble and everything, they're thinking of divorcing. Usually at least one of them is depressed and so on. So they come to a marital therapist for help. And, of course, by the time they've done that, they've usually been on a bad downward course for years, typically. So that they've reached this point of despair and they don't trust each other, things like that. So a problem in marital therapy is to get them to move toward cooperation, kindness. I mean, some of the things we're talking about in that context is difficult because they're defensive. They don't want to be hurt again. And in a case like that, then I think if you could, at the beginning of each marital counseling session, you could use this kind of repeated subliminal priming and have the kind of effects we're seeing there, even if small, it might help the therapist, help them move toward talking about the issues. The person I'm working with, this is named Sue Johnson, and she is a researcher and a marital clinician at University of Waterloo. And she already has been studying attachment-oriented marital therapy, and she has a concept that's called attachment injury. And her belief, based on 25 years of working with couples, is that almost always there are a few critical injuries to one or both people. And some examples are, of course, sexual infidelity. One partner had sex with someone else. But surprisingly common are other violations of the person's belief that they could have counted on their partner during a miscarriage, for example. There are several examples she gave me where the husband, probably because he couldn't really handle, couldn't cope with this himself, was perceived by the wife who's giving birth this thing is tremendously sad about it, that it seems to her like he didn't help, that he wasn't there. So during the marital therapy, the therapist has to ease them toward how exactly did this happen. And one of the things is, if you can keep them calmed down, it'll be revealed that he felt terrible while doing it and afterwards about not, they're fighting about this, and at a certain level he knows that he was, what he did was wrong, but he's defending himself. He doesn't want to say, yeah, I'm a terrible person. So the whole method involves easing them toward this thing so that both of them can say how they felt about it. And when it works, and she's shown that it does work, you suddenly get both of them, honestly expressing their feelings and affection for each other. It's like instead of they're both defending themselves and accusing each other, they both show their vulnerability. So that's an example. So I would look upon it as a facilitating factor, but in no way that it could replace reconstructing their whole relationship by other means.
So his audience was saying that although he's not very sure but whether it's a similar process that is involved, but it seems to make sense what you are saying, that this kind of unconscious priming may kind of make the individual more disposed towards a particular type of therapy or counsel. Even in our day-to-day experience for practitioners, we do find that sometimes some individual may not feel like meditating upon impermanence at all. The idea of reflecting upon death and impermanence may be so unappealing, but as a result of some other methods, some other practices, which has no direct relevance, it may make the individual kind of more disposed towards that kind of contemplation, and then at a later point, it just comes much more easily. Similarly, the same phenomenon may be occurring in our daily experiences, where you may have had some experience, say, yesterday, and then today you are no longer conscious of this, but because of that, there is some lingering effect of that. Your mood might be better, or mood might be kind of sadder. You're not thinking about the event. It's not conscious, but the effect is still lingering.
Yes. Another example is dreams. A lot of times, people are waking up and they're already in some mental state, and they don't know that they've been dreaming about this. So I think it's very kind. Another sitting here in the presence of this picture reminds me, too, that Mario did some experiments where the prime, the security-inducing prime, was Picasso's drawing of his mother holding a baby. And one of the things we've talked about just informally is that, and again, I don't want to sound like a continually critic of American culture, but this is a good place to do it. Our actual lives around there typically are television programs of violence, rape, news stories of war, people fighting, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And so the primed environment is one that's threatening and sort of conducive to thinking about having ready images of striking back, violence, things like that. So I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, just changing the daily environment with artworks, other kinds of things would have probably a subtle effect, but it would be conducive toward, you know, a different mental state. So I think there are probably many examples.
So,
Again, this may be just a pure conjecture, but also this may explain the significance for the monastic members to change their very appearance, because the fact that they chose to wear a particular type of clothes is there to, at the conscious level, to remind themselves of their vows and that they are a monk. And even at the subconscious, unconscious level, this may have an impact as well. One cannot discount that. And also in Vajrayana practitioners, sometimes the practitioners at specific points of the practices wear certain types of apparels that include human bones, again, which would, you know, constantly keep in the back of the mind the sense of impermanence and the death. So these could be probably the reason, although there is no explicit theories about why these are done. Probably these are some.
I thought I'd like to bring the discussion back to the question, the original question, which was about the ethics of giving people information without awareness. This is actually an old technique. We knew about it for 50 years. And when they first introduced it, it was in movie theaters, and they had briefly flashed the word, buy popcorn. And they did studies to show that it significantly increased the amount of Coke that was bought. So it did affect people's behavior. This has been well documented like 50 years ago. So we know this technique can actually change people's behavior. And the question is, we should have a discussion about whether this should be allowed. I think that's the question. And I'd like to propose, for example, in the States, probably in most countries, we have what's called a federal drug administration. So before you can give anybody a drug, it has to be cleared by this group of people who decide if the benefits outweigh the disadvantages. I would like to propose that we have a similar group on the basis of what I said yesterday, and I'll come back to this issue, that we have a federal education administration. That is, you can't implement particular educational curricula without showing that they're effective. In this context, perhaps, you know, we could establish a federal media administration or information administration to make sure, for example, that the information that the media is giving the people is true, and A, and B, is given with their awareness, for example. I mean, it seems to me like that's a very reasonable thing to do, just to make sure that people are given the correct information and given it with their awareness. And that kind of a group, I mean, the scientists could say, we have this technique, we know what it does, these are the implications. Then you have the discussion with everybody.
Just to emphasize on what Phil was saying, I remember walking in the street of New York with a Tibetan friend of mine and looking at the advertisements. So, not speaking, subliminal is pretty rare, but the actual thing we see. And he was saying, these are stealing our mind. So that was quite a neat formula. And so this is also a product of a culture which is based on this gross national product idea. Yeah. And so now, if you look at the same environment in countries where the gross national happiness is more like a priority, let's say in Tibet or Bhutan, when you look around, of course, you don't see Coca-Cola written on the rocks. You basically see prayers carved, may all sentient beings be happy and free from suffering. If you see flags, they are not advertisements for oil companies or something. They are, again, prayers that are supposed to be carried by the wind, and at least when you see them, you think, may the wind, wherever the wind blows, may the being be free from suffering. So every single aspect of the actual environment, which is the product of the culture, is also reminding that instead of constantly stealing your mind by this, do that.